Welcome to Lifestyle Medicine with Dr. Brian Asbell. This video is brought to you by Integrative Family Medicine of Asheville.
The issue really is, for me, as I've become, as Chad said, I've become more interested in lifestyle medicine, and partly because I've been frustrated with taking care of patients for 14 years as a cardiologist and seeing the same events happen to the same people, no matter really what we've done for them or to them. Bypass surgeries, stents, statins, aspirin, you know, all the stuff that we can do and give and prescribe has really not changed the course of their illness. And that for me has been an increasing frustration to the point that I felt like, you know, I've got to do something else and to make a difference. And part of that, not doing this before 14 years or 13 years at the time, was that I was sort of paralyzed by the enormity of the task to change from being a cardiologist to a lifestyle medicine practitioner seemed overwhelming, particularly with, you know, where I was in my life, my practice, and I wasn't sure with the hospital alignment with my practice, were they going to be interested in this? And so the more I thought about it, the more nothing happened, until finally I said, look, I've just got to do something. So we took a very baby step and started CHIP, which I'll tell you more about in a minute, about a year ago, and very well received, very successful, and sort of reinforced to me that this is clearly a move in the right direction. And so now we're again paralyzed by the enormity of the task, but also going to start, hopefully, offering soon the Dean Ornish program for cardiovascular disease reversal and prevention as intensive cardiac rehab. For those who have gone through cardiac rehabilitation, you have to have some certain diagnoses to be able to participate in that: chronic stable angina or chest pain, recent stent, recent bypass surgery, recent valve surgery, you know, big things, bad things have had to happen. So we had cardiac rehab program for a long time. Now we're talking about adding intensive cardiac rehab, and I think that there are opportunities to not only teach the adults, but to teach the kids. I just became a board member of ASAP, Appalachian Sustainable Agriculture Program, and they have a Growing Minds program for teaching kids how, where their food comes from and what a difference it makes. And I think that there's an opportunity to teach the providers, or teach the teachers, if you will. We're talking about starting a conference, hopefully in the spring of 2017, we got to get going, where we would invite practitioners, doctors, nurse practitioners, PAs, nurses, et cetera, to talk about lifestyle medicine. So there's a lot that I think is going to happen in the next, you know, 3 years in Asheville moving in this direction. I'm going to start, that was kind of the outline of what we're going to talk about. I think everybody saw that. It really starts here in a lot of ways. And obesity really is the common denominator of chronic disease. And about a third of adults in the United States are obese. I don't see kids, so you guys could probably tell me that. I suspect that it's, you know, not quite as bad in adults as it is in adults, but getting there. About a third are overweight, and an increasing number of morbidly obese. And there's certainly cost to those individual patients, but there's also significant cost to the healthcare system. I don't have an MPH, Master's in Public Health, but I think it's about 18% now of the gross domestic product is spent on healthcare, and that number is increasing, and that's just not a sustainable number. Along with the increase in obesity is an increase, an epidemic, really, in diabetes. In 1945, you could see that diabetes was almost unheard of. And now in 2015, you've got about a 30% chance as an adult over 60 of having type 2 diabetes, which is in a lot of ways considered cardiovascular disease risk equivalent, because diabetics, for example, who have not had an event, cardiac event, or any sort of vascular event, who are treated with a statin, are even at higher risk than those who are not diabetic, who have had a heart attack, and are on a statin, which we know reduces the risk of subsequent events. So diabetics are very high risk, so it's not a good thing to have. It is reversible, is the good news. So if you are diabetic here, don't, or on at home watching, don't panic. There is hope, but there's got to be change. So you keep continuing to do the same thing is insanity. I think somebody was at, who said that quote about insanity is doing things the same way and expecting a different result. So you have to do things differently, but it is reversible. Next slide, please. So most of you don't know William Osler, but William Osler was one of the giants of medicine back in the day, less than 100 years ago. He wrote a textbook called The Prevalence of Coronary Heart Disease in North America. And he said this: you can expect one heart attack per year in an average hospital in an average-sized town. So Asheville is perhaps slightly larger than an average-sized town. I don't know how that was defined. Certainly back then, smaller. But we have, I think, 23 adult cardiologists in my group, 3 pediatric cardiologists, and we have 40 cardiologists in our regional practice. Rutherfordton, Marion, Brevard, Hendersonville, and Franklin. So 40 cardiologists, and one heart attack per year, we would clearly be doing something else. Today, there are about 1.5 million heart attacks in the United States. I see almost every time I'm on call for 8 hours, my average number of heart attacks that I would personally take care of would be 2. And it's expensive. We do about, in the United States, this is old, this is from the New England Journal of Medicine 2009, but we do about 400,000 bypass surgeries a year, where your chest is cut open. We do something called a sternotomy, where they literally take a skill saw and they saw your chest open, and then these retractors come in and they crank it down and it pulls the chest open so the surgeon can see the heart. It's open about that far, and you can really see the beating heart. I should have tried to incorporate a video for this group so you could see what we're talking about. They're expensive. They are difficult to recover from. It takes about 4 or 5 days in the hospital and then about several weeks at home before you're able to drive again and you're cleared by the surgeon. They are effective. They clearly have been shown to prolong life in certain subsets of patients, particularly those whose heart muscle squeezing function is weakened and who have blockage in all 3 of their major heart arteries. That's definitely a subset of patients who would be felt to live longer if they have that surgery, but it's clearly something you don't want to have. About 40% or so of the bypasses, the veins they take out of your leg to divert the blood flow around the blockage, about 40% of those will become blocked over the period of about 12 months to 18 months. Blocked, I mean 75% blocked or more. They aren't perfect. The bypass that we use from the inside your chest wall, called the internal mammary artery, that one really does seem to stay open a lot better, but you only have one. On this side, you have one on this side. But when we use them both, it makes this incision harder to heal. So it's a give or take. We do more than twice that many angioplasties and stents, which is kind of what my group does. I used to do them. I don't need to do them now. We do about 1 million a year. Again, not a panacea. There's even a smaller number of patients or population of patients that have mortality benefit from that, who actually live longer by having had that procedure. It really is mostly used for relief of chest discomfort, angina or angina, either pronunciation is correct. They work quite well to relieve that symptom of exertional chest discomfort because you've got a blockage and your heart's not getting enough blood flow and it hurts. We put a stent in, that helps that significantly. So it can be very much life-changing, improving, to have that procedure done. But we see about 20% of those stents become restenosed or reblocked within a period of about a year. So again, not the answer for everyone, and something that we can do a better job of. So this is something that my father found and emailed me, and I don't know if you can read it in the back. It says, so now, the patient says, so now what, doctor? Coronary bypass, don't worry. It's one of the most common surgeries in the world today, and it is. Any alternative? Yes, but it's considered too radical by modern medicine. Go on a plant-based diet, and by hospital regulations, I must advise against it. Really, why? $200,000 for the surgery, zilch for the diet. Do the math. So the hospitals are not completely at fault here. But, you know, clearly that's how they make their money. I mean, hospitals make money and doctors make money in this system by doing procedures, not really so much by seeing patients. Next. So this is actually, this quote, "Let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food," what has been widely attributed to Hippocrates, but it's actually not found in any of the 60 texts of the Corpus Hippocraticum. We cannot find this quote. He might have said it, but he didn't write it down. So this is actually one of my patients that I just took this picture a couple weeks ago. You can still see his incision here. This is 2 days after his bypass surgery. And this is his breakfast of eggs, scrambled eggs, 2 pieces of sausage. And he tells me, don't worry, they're turkey sausage. And skillet fried potatoes. And this is you know, working on repeat business as far as I'm concerned. This I asked him, what is that thing? He said, that is my fiber supplement. True story. And he said, do you want it? And I said, no, I thought it would be completely too weird to take a picture of him with my cell phone and then eat his fiber supplement on the way out of the door. So I declined. But I did put the top on this, move it back, and I moved the cantaloupe up and said, you know, knock it out. So there's fiber in this, there's fiber in this, there's actually some fiber in the potatoes, but there's no fiber in any of that. Next slide, please.
So do you suspect that the 400 doctors that you're speaking with shortly will find that funny or understand why it might be funny?
Yes. I think they will. You know, I think you have to be a little bit careful. I have to be a little bit careful when I talk about a plant-based diet, because that if you really hit that completely, I think that there are going to be some people in the audience who are going to roll their eyes, close their books, and say, you know, we're done. It is the last lecture of the day of the conference, so, you know, they can leave early. But you know, we could spend a lot of time on that, and maybe we'll come back to that, you know, plant-based issue at the end. Likewise, I think that prescription drugs are not the answer. There are about 180,000 serious or fatal adverse drug reactions reported to the FDA annually. Bill Hathaway is one of my partners who has been in practice here for, I think, 16 years now. He's now the chief medical officer of Mission Hospital. He is kind of a part-time cardiologist now. I think he's 20% cardiology, and he's 100% chief medical officer, so I don't know how he's doing it. But I helped him move into his new house yesterday, and he's clearly feeling the stress. But nevertheless, he asked me to give a talk with him about 2 years ago at MAHAC about adverse drug reactions. And the next two slides are from that talk. And this is one of those audience response systems, you know, where you push the button. But to save a little time, I've highlighted the correct answer. The annual cost for adverse drug reactions are greater than the total cost for cardiovascular or diabetic care in the United States as of 2010. Whoa. Next. Also, there are enough prescriptions filled annually in the United States to average 10 prescriptions for every person in the United States. That is a major problem. On average, once you get to about 8 prescriptions, the pharmacists tell me that there is nearly 100% chance that there is an adverse drug reaction between your medicines. Now, it might not be something that's clinically significant. It might just be you have more muscle pain, but you're fine. Or you're having, you know, something else, but you're, you know, it's fine, it's manageable. You might not even attribute it to your medications, but it's a problem. So this really doesn't make sense. I mean, this is where we are today. We are very good. We have a very expensive but very good system for mopping up. And we're experts at mopping. But really, this is a system that is a losing system. We can't mop up enough. We can't. People are getting bigger, more diabetes, sicker, older. And we can't continue along this path because we just can't afford it. We need to turn off the faucets, and that's what we're talking about. Next slide. So, you know, what is the solution? I think that the solution is lifestyle medicine. About 80% or so, 70 to 80% of chronic diseases, including vascular disease, heart disease, stroke, are attributable to poor lifestyle choices. And I think if you can get rid of, in a perfect world, we'll never get there, of course, but if you can reverse 80% of chronic illness, why wouldn't you? So lifestyle medicine is, by definition, it is evidence-based practice of helping individuals and families adopt and sustain natural, healthy behaviors that affect health and quality of life. This is not just trying to get you to live longer, but trying to get you to live better and have a higher quality of life. Next. And evidence-based is very key. These are some of the pioneers of lifestyle medicine. I stole this slide from Dr. Deisinger, who gave this talk at Stanford. It was an invited lecture a couple of years ago. I think many of you might know Dean Ornish. Dr. Ornish, whom I talked to the other day about bringing his program here, he, about 30 years ago now, I guess, was the first physician to show that you, by simply changing your diet, you could actually reverse heart disease. Small group of patients, major headlines, Newsweek, Time Magazine, everyone was talking about it for about a week, and then the next issue came out, and then phew, we're back to the same practice. But, you know, like a lot of good ideas, you know, Galileo was excommunicated. Its time, I think, has come. I think we're finally starting to see that politicians are starting to see that we've got to do something about our healthcare system. If you've never read the book, The China Study, this is T. Colin Campbell, that is well worth your time. It might not be something that you believe, but I would encourage you to read it. It is easy. You don't have to be a scientist or a doctor to read that book and get a lot out of it. Fascinating, absolutely fascinating. And this is Caldwell Esselstyn, who was a surgeon, a thyroid surgeon, actually at the Cleveland Clinic. He was, in a lot of cases, derided for saying, you know, there's a better way, and we've got to change. He wrote a book called Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease that I gave to a patient of mine, and I won't be able to tell this story next week because I've used up my 20 minutes, but since you said I had longer. He wrote this book, and a patient gave it to me, which is kind of how it works for me sometimes, you know. A patient gave it to me, I read it and said, wow. So I gave it to another patient who came in, he was 65-ish, maybe 60s, lived part of the year in Cleveland and part of the year here, not one of the more common half and halves. And he came to see me for a second opinion because he had had two bypass surgeries, two separate surgical procedures to reroute the blood flow, and was having angina on a daily basis and really was having chest pain. He was taking about 9 or 7 nitroglycerin a day to get through the day. Hardly a high quality of life. He was to walk the dog, to get the paper, to take a shower, nitro beforehand so that he wouldn't get chest pain. And it was stable, but he was recommended to him by his doctor in Ohio to have a third bypass surgery. He said, what do you think about that? And I said, well, honestly, I've had two patients and this is about 4 years ago. I've had two patients that have had three bypass surgeries and they're both dead. They lasted about 2 years. You've kind of used up all your conduits. You've used up all your bypass options at that time. You don't have any more veins in the legs that can be used or arteries that can be used. So we tend to use cadaveric veins. We use veins from, you know, dead people. And they aren't your body, and so they don't last long. Your body has sort of a reaction to that, sort of an accelerated cholesterol buildup process. And I said, have this book, okay? A patient gave me this book. You got nothing to lose. Try this. And it's very strict. I mean, we're all in. When you're that desperate, you're all in. I mean, you're going to do something. He said, I'll do anything. I said, well, try. For 3 months, do this and come back and see me. It was all about a whole food, plant-based diet. So it was a vegan diet. No nuts and no oils. Whoa. I've tried a few of the recipes, not bad, but I think 3 months on that diet would be difficult for me. But he did it, and he came back 3 months later, and he had lost 27 pounds, which was great. He needed that. He had about a 100-point drop in his cholesterol. There is no cholesterol in plants. It's only in animal products. Got him off a couple of his cholesterol medications. But the thing that was most impressive to me about this man was that within 1 week of changing his diet, he had not used a single nitroglycerin pill in 3 months, and was walking on a treadmill for 30 minutes a day at whatever speed and whatever, you know, incline. I told him, I said, there is nothing that I could have done for you that would have been remotely as beneficial to you as what you did. He has now moved full time to Ohio, and actually he and his wife are good friends with Caldwell Elsestein and his wife, and have actually, you know, they have dinner together, and very interesting. He sent me a Christmas card last Christmas and said, I have to report that I've had a stent to one of my bypass grafts since I saw you last. But, you know, far, far better than what I could have done. And that really was the guy that sort of changed my feeling about medicine and made me feel like we've got to do something different. Hopefully somebody will ask about that at the conference, maybe in the Q&A. These are just sort of, you're going to have to keep going. So lifestyle interventions include, of course, nutrition, exercise, physical activity, stress reduction, stress management, rest, sleep, meditation, social supports, and also smoking cessation and getting rid of toxins. This is critically important. You have to stop smoking if you have vascular disease. But all of these are important. I knew this was important. I knew this was important. Wasn't so sure about this. Not my expertise. I'm just not trained in this, but I'm getting smarter about this. Scott McGregor, you guys know Scott. Scott's a friend, and he does a mind-body stress reduction class. And I've talked to Scott a little bit about this. I need to, that's where I talked to Chad about this initially, the opening of that movie. What was that movie?
The Connection.
The Connection. Excellent. Mind-body connection. And I need to touch base with Scott again and say, you know, how do you want to be involved in this as we go forward? So really, this is the treatment triangle, and this is sort of where we are now. It's really upside down, a couple more, four more hits. You know, this should be the base of the triangle. Lifestyle medicine, I think, should be right above it. Physiologic therapies above that, and then finally medications and surgery. And the problem, of course, is that we're an upside down pyramid right now. Next slide. So lifestyle medicine, thankfully, is growing significantly. I want to share with you a little bit about the growth numbers and then the growth drivers. This is from last year's American College of Lifestyle Medicine board meeting, and this is February 2011, and membership was just over 100, and now it is, in the last 4 years, it has grown exponentially. If you're a company or a group that's got trying to get started, you know, this is the sort of growth that you want to see. And I'm also pleased to report that the majority of this growth is attributed to new physician membership. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that group or a member of the group, but I just joined the group about a year ago. They have a journal that they send out. You can elect to get it paper, you can get it online. Excellent, really well done. Their conference I'm going to in Nashville at the very beginning of November. The lineup is just, the lineup of speakers is incredible. I mean, it's Dean Ornish, David Katz, Dan Buettner, who wrote The Blue Zones. If you haven't ever read that book, that's also worth your time, talking about the groups of people in the world who live to be 100 most often. Sardinia, Okinawa, Japan, and surprisingly to me, Loma Linda, California. I thought, you know, the United States has a group of people that lives to be 100 more often than everyone else in the world? No way. Sorry? Seventh-day Adventists, that's exactly what it was. And many of them, as you know, many of them are vegetarian or vegan. And we've actually broken it down, interestingly, to look at the Seventh-day Adventists who eat meat, who are vegetarian, and who are vegan, and what happens to them. And I don't have all the statistics, and I won't go into more than that, except to say that the vegan ones have far lower incidence of vascular disease and diabetes compared to their meat-eating counterparts. Very interesting. Next. So there are four real lifestyle medicine growth drivers, and the first one is the chronic disease epidemic, which we've already talked about. And I, again, in the interest of time, I'm not going to go further into this. The second one, increasing healthcare costs. Next. And this is something that is really more for the meeting next weekend, but this is the national health spending per capita in the United States, and this line is the United States line, far, far above most of the other developed countries, which are, you know, sort of in the same ballpark. But we're way above everyone else. We're more than twice we're almost twice everyone else, and our outcomes are not twice as good as everyone else's. We're number one by far in how much we spend on our health care. And we are, I don't know, you guys might know, we're like number 40 internationally in our outcomes. Next is dissatisfaction with the status quo, and that's really on the part of patients and physicians. Next. This is interesting. This is a year ago, a Saturday morning, I was reading my iPad, and this was interesting. This is the heart.org. You can get on this website yourself, on Medscape Cardiology, and a source that a lot of cardiologists use on a regular basis for our sort of continuing medical education. And I was pleased to see that the top 10 most read articles by cardiologists last month, number one was, "Let's stop the unnecessary treatment of heart disease." So that spoke to me that cardiologists, not just, you know, me, are frustrated with the system. And this is you can't see this, and I'll read it for you. "Let's be clear and honest, lifestyle-related disease is largely unnecessary." Next. Another article, this is from January, this is "Heart Disease and Lifestyle, Why Are Doctors in Denial?" And this is easier to read. This Dr. Mandrola is an electrophysiologist, says, "The one thing I cannot get over is that I am a doctor, not a proceduralist. I am tasked with helping people be well. I fail in that task if I ignore the most effective and safest treatment option. I fail if I take the easy path. The prescription pad is easy. The EP lab, the electrophysiologic lab, is easy. The truth is hard." It is. Next. And then finally, another growth driver is science. And I want to just go over with you a little bit about some of the clinical trials and our experience with CHIP. So again, targeted more to next week's class or next week's group, but this is from the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. This is sort of the cardiology Bible. And this is like the New England Journal of Medicine for internal medicine. This is the source. This was from earlier this year, about 89,000 women in the second nurses health study, young, no history of cancer, cardiovascular disease, or diabetes. I use a lot of abbreviations, and I'll try to make sure that I explain to you what those are. And they looked at six lifestyle factors that define healthy living here. Obviously, no smoking was one. Diet in the top 40% of the healthy eating index. I actually have no idea what that is, but you probably want to be in the top 40%. Physical activity at least 2.5 hours a week, TV watching less than 7 hours a week. That seemed like super easy for me until I realized that Saturdays I probably do watch 2 football games. BMI less than 25, and alcohol not more than 1 a day. These two are probably go hand in hand. Next. 2 football games and beer. At 20 years of follow-up, those who had all 6 healthy lifestyle habits compared to those who had none, had a 92% lower risk of cardiovascular disease, 90,000 young women. Wow. The problem with that is only about 5% of the study population were optimal. That's probably not that surprising. It's a little surprising to me that it was that low, but that's part of the problem, is educating people and then getting them to stick with the plan. You've got to know to make the change, then you've got to make the change, and then you have to have the change stick. This is from last fall. You know, what about men? That was all women. This is 21,000 men, a little bit older population, followed first 11 years. Similar 5 lifestyle factors: healthy diet, smoking, moderate alcohol consumption, physical activity, and abdominal adiposity, fat. 79% lower risk if they met all lifestyle factors, but men, 1%. 1% had 5. 5% of women had 6. You can derive whatever conclusion you wish from that. Men failed. And this is PREDIMED, and maybe some of you are familiar with this. This is a couple of years old, and I might add a slide here, but this is sort of the synopsis of this. This is in the New England Journal of Medicine. PREDIMED randomized people with vascular disease who had a heart attack or had a stroke or had an abdominal aneurysm or have lower extremity blockage and painful legs when they walk, and randomized them either to a low-fat diet or to a Mediterranean-style diet, rich in fruits, vegetables, fiber, because of the fruits and vegetables. You didn't have to have the supplement. Legumes, beans and peas, some olive oil, some wine, some fish, but not no very low in red meat and dairy. And, premature. What they found was that there was about a 30% reduction in the composite endpoint of cardiovascular death, heart attack, and stroke, compared to about the same. I tell my patients about a third lower risk if I put you on statin treatment, which would be the standard of care. About a 50% reduction in the risk of diabetes on that diet compared to about a 30% reduction in risk of diabetes if we put you on something like metformin, which would have been one of the more common medications we'd start you on for your diabetes or your insulin resistance, your pre-diabetes. So the bottom line here is those other two trials were observational studies. We didn't break them up. We just followed them and saw what happened. This was actually a randomized trial. What happens if we change your diet? And what we find is that it is at least as good as, if not better, than what we are doing now with medications now next. So CHIP, the Complete Health Improvement Program, is one that we brought to Asheville last fall. Next, and I'll tell you a little bit about what we did there. It is a lifestyle intervention education program. It is 100% evidence-based, which is what, as a doctor, not so much a scientist, but as a doctor, I recognize that we can't change doctors' behavior if we don't have some programs that are really evidence-based. I mean, they want to see the evidence. They are completely bombarded on a regular basis by the evidence from all of these clinical trials where we randomize patients to get this drug or that drug or this procedure or that procedure. We've got to give them the same sort of information, rigorous scientific information, to prove to them that this works, or they're not going to change their behavior. And if they don't change their behavior, fewer of you are going to change your behavior. It's community-based. It's not residential, like the Pritikin Longevity Institute, which some of you may be familiar with in Miami. Very expensive, beautiful, ritzy, resortish type environment. It works. You go down there, you exercise, you eat right. Everything's perfect. Pools. I mean, it's very nice. Liz Gardner, you guys know Liz? Liz told me that in her training that she actually spent some time there, like 3 weeks there as a rotation, which I thought was just, I was blown away.
What's the cost?
Oh, it's incredibly expensive. It's about $5,000 a week, not for everyone. And so I recognize that it's just a very small subset of the patients who need it. So we need a program like CHIP where it's portable and we can do it in the communities and offer it to you at a far, far lower cost in a real world environment too. Regular group sessions over several weeks, you have your blood drawn and we do health risk assessments, which are very in-depth. You fill it out, all of your risk of health, do you exercise, what are you eating, how do you deal with stress, how often do you sleep, are you a smoker, are you not, are you overweight? And then we put in all the medical data. We put in the triglycerides, the cholesterol, the good cholesterol, the bad cholesterol, the blood pressure, the blood sugars, and you get a very in-depth document on your health. It's a whole of health approach, and the most important thing to me about this, again, was it was published in a lot of peer-reviewed journals, and that was, I read most of them, but not all of them, and I said, this is what we need to do. This is sort of what it looks like. It's about 90 minutes. There are two different tracks. You can do a 50-minute session for businesses where they can sort of fit it into their lunch hour, or you can do an hour and a half, which is what we've done in the community. It's about half videotaped content, done very well done by the Lifestyle Medicine Institute. If you go to the website, I think it's chiphealth.com. I can't remember if it's an org or com. I think it's a com. Chiphealth.com. You can get an idea of some of these videotapes are like. Very, very well done and fun. I mean, really funny professional lecture. About half of it is facilitated group discussion. I don't think that you really, it's harder anyway for you to make change on your own. Most of the behavioral medicine says that change is best made when there's sort of some group dynamic to hold you accountable. Knowing that other people not only hold you accountable, but sort of share the struggle. You know, this is not just me. we're all in this together, and how are you doing it? How are you being successful? And how am I being successful? And how can we learn from each other? It's sort of based on these four recurring questions. We do have food samples that we've partnered with Whole Foods to provide some food samples for us. They do some cooking demonstrations. We actually have a now support group for those who've finished the program, and they've offered their space upstairs for us to have a once monthly meeting, which I thought was really fabulous. I mean, it works for everybody. It works for them. It works for us. Next. So does it work? So this was published, now published in the American Journal of Cardiology. And this is a busy, but I'll just summarize it, I think, very simply for you in the red circles. We look at cholesterol, we look at triglycerides, we look at glucose, we look at some other things. But in cholesterol, if your total cholesterol was greater than 280, I don't know if you can see that in the back, after 30 days in this program, we were seeing about a 20% reduction in your total cholesterol. Very impressive. So 28 minus, 56, pretty good. Getting you down to 220 range. Still too high, probably, but a big change. Triglycerides are very responsive to diet. And if you had triglycerides in the greater than 500 range, which is very high, that's the level at which we would expect you to potentially develop something called pancreatitis. Very, very painful abdominal pain. We see about almost a 50% reduction. Fasting glucose, if you're one of the definitions of diabetes is a fasting blood glucose of greater than 125, so 126 or greater. About 525 patients were there initially. After 30 days, down to 300, so almost half. No longer met that definition of diabetes, about a 20% reduction. So Asheville CHIP, we had 22 people in our first group, and these are our 30-day results. The average weight was 228. The average weight loss was about 10 pounds in the first 30 days. It's a 4% decrease. The total cholesterol was down about 14%. LDL down about 16%. LDL is the bad cholesterol. I remembered it in medical school, L for lethal, H for healthy. Triglycerides, 25%. Average glucose was down 7%, and systolic blood pressure was down about the same. And then at 12 weeks, this is from CHIP 2. This is the second group that we did, and this was March, April, May of this year. 27 participants this time lost a total of 363 pounds, which is an average weight loss of about 13.5 pounds per person, about 61.5 inches of waist circumference, so about 2.25 inches of waist circumference per patient. One man, my patient, lost 8 inches. I mean, if that's not life-changing, I don't know what is. It's expensive because he had to go buy a lot of new clothes. 17 people, only 17, I was kind of surprised, had a fasting glucose of greater than 100. Greater than 100 is considered the cutoff for impaired fasting glucose, or sort of, if you will, pre-diabetes. 8 of them lowered their glucose to less than 100 at 12 weeks. Similar results with lipids. Only 6 had a total cholesterol of over 200, which is kind of surprising. Again, I think it's because most of them were already on statin therapy, which drops your cholesterol so significantly. Of the 6 that had a total cholesterol of over 200, their average was 242, and at 30 days it had dropped by 20%. 16 patients had LDL greater than 100, which is sort of the 20th percentile in the United States, so 80% have higher LDLs than that. 30 days it dropped by 24%. 8 had triglycerides greater than 150, which is considered abnormal, but not really at risk for pancreatitis. Their average was 235, and after 90 days, 17% decrease. So we know it works. We know lifestyle medicine works. And so then the question is, does it stick? I mean, if you can do it at 30 and 90 days, that's great. But what happens at a year and a half? And this is looking at medication after an MI, a heart attack, in the community. And what we find here next is that at 18 months, next again, you get about a 70% reduction or 70% adherence to medical therapy. So compare that to lifestyle, again, looking at 18 months physical activity and dietary behavior, the average here is also about 70%. So again, lifestyle works as well as, if not better than, medical therapy, and the adherence to a lifestyle medicine program or lifestyle is about the same as adherence to medical therapy 18 months after you've had a heart attack. Next. One more. So, you know, this is, again, directed more to my colleagues next week, but if we know that it works, and we know that it still works a year and a half out after you've been, you know, indoctrinated, if you will, so why don't we use it? Well, I think one of the things is that cardiologists are used to guideline-driven medicine. We are graded. I don't know if you know your physicians are being graded, but we're being graded on how much we adhere to published guidelines. So if you have a heart attack and you come in 2 months later to see me and you have a weakened heart muscle from your heart attack, I have to have you on, based on where you are, I have to have you on an aspirin, a statin, a beta blocker, an ACE inhibitor. If you're a diabetic, I need to be controlling that. That's already 5. That's just walking in the door. So I'm getting graded on that, and I have 15 minutes. I notice that you guys, it says 2 or 3 times longer to meet with your patients. If I'm your cardiologist, I regret to tell you that I will see most of you for 15 minutes a year. So, you know, we don't have a lot of time to talk about lifestyle in that sort of environment. And I think that's about the national average. So you need a good doctor who can see you, because it's not going to be the cardiologist until you have your next event. I mean, a lot of my patients I see again because they didn't make it to the next year to see me. They saw me in the hospital with some other event. Cardiologists don't have time. We've talked about that. They're not trained in behavioral medicine techniques. You know, that's not our comfort zone. You know, I am very comfortable talking to you, or was very comfortable talking to you, about medications, about the disease process. I'm certainly comfortable doing that. I should be. I've done it for 14 years. I ought to be able to tell you what happened in terms that, you know, you can understand. And then I can tell you why this study showed that this medicine made a difference, or that medicine made a difference, or why the guidelines show that you ought to be on these things. But I'm not trained, or I wasn't trained, to talk to you about stress management. I wasn't trained to talk to you about even smoking cessation. I wasn't trained to talk to you about diet. Most of us, frankly, have no idea what was in the medical literature about diet. You guys are a little bit younger than me. I'm 47, almost 48. But we didn't have hardly any medical training in medical school. I mean, I probably had 2 hours of nutrition in 4 years of medical school. So it's not where we're comfortable. And then, of course, the sense of sort of the defeatist mentality that the whole world's against us. I only have 15 minutes. Why bother?
Where did the 15 minutes come from? Well, it's money somehow. I'm sitting here.
It's worse than that. It's actually worse than that, okay? I'm really going to send you over the top here. We're going to call 911 after you hear this. So it's not only that you have 15 minutes, I have 15 minutes. It's that I personally I think that my recent number, I'm around 300 patients behind. So I am so busy that I don't have time. I was supposed to see you back in a year. I have 300 patients that are due to see me, and I don't have a place to put them, despite having only 30 minutes for my new patients and 15 minutes for my return patients. We look at something called the third visit out, not my next visit, because there might be a cancellation. So a true idea of how behind a practice is sort of the third next visit. Does that make sense? Not the next visit, but when's my third visit? And mine is in November. Okay, so it's September, and I am 2 months away from having 3 office spaces open.
And you're going fishing?
I am, because stress reduction is so important. It was either that or drink a lot more. So, you know, it's a broken system. I mean, it's not our fault. It's not. We're hiring. I'm the recruiting coordinator. So, you know, we're hiring. We hired 2 new cardiologists now. We can't hire enough cardiologists to meet the need. We can't do it. I hear you. I mean, believe me, I hear you 100%.
It's not that to me, and I was in the medical field for a few years, and I saw interns who had gone through the program and said if they had known what it was going to be like,
yeah,
they would never have done it.
Yeah.
Now they've got all this educational debt.
Yep.
What are they going to do?
Right.
So somehow money is in here.
Oh, no question about it.
And
there's no question about
why?
It.
The insurance companies are charging more and covering less. People can't afford. Is this covered by insurance?
That's a very good question. Let me come back to that in just a minute, because I only have two more slides, and then it will, that is my next question. Next. So possible solutions. You know, I think that this is where we have to go. I don't think that you can ask a cardiologist in this example to handle this. You have to have a some sort of program that you can then reasonably expect the cardiologist to refer to. You have to have a wellness program employing team-based care. This is not new. This has been studied a million times. We know that when you employ team-based care with a nutritionist, an exercise physiologist, a medical director, a nurse, a health behavior coach, those sort of things, that is the system that works. So you have to get the patient. My job really would then be to get the patient to that program so that the magic can happen. I think that the hospital has to sort of take some ownership of this. More and more physician groups are employed by the hospital, and it's just what it is. And so the physicians and the hospitals together, this is no longer the doctor's problem, this is the healthcare system's problem, and they have to deal with it in some level. Group visits are reimbursable. This is, MNT is medical nutrition therapy. Medical nutrition therapy is reimbursable. Not at the level of a bypass surgery or stent, but it is reimbursable. I think we need a cardiac prehab program. That's a term that I made up. Somebody else probably made it up and has probably used it now. But it's prehab as well as rehab. I mean, rehab's fine. If you've had the event, it works. But prehab would be way better, right? You don't want to have to have the event. You don't want to qualify for intensive cardiac rehab. You don't want to have to need disease reversal. You want to have disease prevention. And I think that CHIP is one program that would be very good in a prehab thing. And frankly, I think that we need to advocate more at a national level. And frankly, the discussion just needs to start. You know, that's why I was so pleased that they asked me to talk about this at the meeting next week, is we need to get cardiologists thinking about being aware of these sort of things. You have to have the knowledge, then you have to have a system, and then you have to follow up. So we're sort of at the get the knowledge stage right now, but that's okay, because you got to start somewhere, and that's the right place to start. Next, I think we're done. Yeah, almost. So this is one I mentioned at the beginning of November. Next, and this is the website. I'm happy to tell you all about it. This is a fabulous conference, you two guys. I mean, this is outstanding. This is Harvard Medical School and the Culinary Institute of America putting on a conference in February or March. It's in Napa Valley in Santa Helena, California. It is fantastic. You get in the kitchen with these CIA chefs. You come home with tons of recipes. It is so well done. It is, you know, talking about Predimed and talking about some of the trials that I mentioned, but with fabulous food. It's over the top good. I mean, it's so good. Next. I've not been to this one, Food is Medicine Next, but it's in San Francisco. It's probably my favorite U.S. area. Exercise is medicine, I've not been to. But I mean, this kind of gives you some hope, right? That the physicians are sort of starting to get the message. Next, and we're done. Oops, sorry, one more. So this is what we're after next week. This is my best friend from college. He's the laparoscopic surgeon at Carolina's Medical Center. And that is a nice, pretty nice redfish. So to answer your question about reimbursability, insurance, yes and no. So the Dean Ornish program is very well reimbursed. Medicare usually leads the charge, and when they do something, then private insurers follow suit. So Medicare does reimburse his program. That's a new event in the last year or so, and they reimburse it quite well. He recommends groups of 15 to participate in his program. A cohort, he calls it a 15. Again, getting back to the sort of the group mentality, the group is the best way to change behavior. And it is reimbursed at, Medicare reimburses it now at about $103 per hour. So a cohort of 15, it's 4 hours at a time, 18 sessions. So it's quite labor intensive, that's 72 hours of time, an hour of exercise, an hour of group discussion and lecture, an hour of meal and sharing things, and an hour of meditation and yoga. And that cohort of 15 is reimbursed $110,000. So that's a lot of money. And the private insurers are usually about 120, 130% of Medicare So that's even more. So that's something that I think makes sense. You know, it works. CHIP is still sort of in the exploration phase. And that's really, frankly, what has held us up the most, is trying to figure out how do we make CHIP financially the most viable. Nationally, patients are charged $5.99 to participate in the program. And it's all over the map what groups are doing. The one in Ohio, they have the greatest experience, I think, they're on CHIP 24 or something. There's also one in Fort Myers, Florida, and they've done a lot of programs. They are actually billing insurance and getting about $1,200 per participant from insurance. From that, they're reimbursing, if they can, they're reimbursing that registration fee of $5.99 to their patients or participants. So we are talking about that now. But yes, we're working.
It's just so hard to understand that this country is the richest country in the world, supposedly, mm-hmm. and yet our health care system is so bad somewhere.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's not just the healthcare system, really. It's the system. I mean, the healthcare system is you know, if you've ever worked or seen the emergency room, they're putting out fires as fast as they can. Nobody has time to step back and say, where are we? They're just trying to survive the day. And, you know, it's the whole system. I mean, it's the food industry.
It's the lack of communication.
Yes.
And until I found integrative medicine, I had no feedback from the doctor.
Right.
It was the nurse that
Oh, sure.
You couldn't.
Yep, yep.
There's no follow-up.
Yep.
So I consider myself one of the lucky ones.
Yeah.
But it just is so hard for me to understand how we got here.
Politically, it's a mess. You know, nobody wants to tackle that. It's completely unpopular to, you know, Obamacare. You love it, you hate it. It's a political nightmare. It's amazing that it even got passed. You know, and then what's going to happen next, I don't know. But, I mean, it helps some people. I'm not making a political statement about Obamacare. I'm just saying that it is hard to get legislation passed that makes a difference because of the fighting about it. Yes, sir?
Well, I was thinking, too, when you were talking about Ornish is now reimbursed by Medicare, and I believe that that was after 19 years of him intensively lobbying.
Yeah, yes.
After that,
yes.
Had the evidence.
Yes. You know, that speaks to the point. You're exactly right. I mean, why should it take 19 years for good science that makes a difference to get to the point where it's finally reimbursed? But at least we're there now.
Yeah.
You know? And if we can just move forward, there's a huge wave of momentum. And I feel like we're just sort of right on the, you know, we're sort of getting up on the wave. And if we can just keep going, I think that we're going to see this whole thing just crash down and we're going to make real headway here. But there's still a lot of long way to go and a lot of resistance.
I just wanted to say, I worked for Dr. Ornish's program about 13 years ago before I moved here to Asheville. Hmm. And it was phased out because mm-hmm. there wasn't reimbursement. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I was thrilled to hear
yeah.
that Medicare's reimbursing. And I just want to comment briefly on the diet, and I hope if you get a chance to speak with Ornish at this conference that you're going to, you'll question it, because it's really, the results that we saw in the program were really phenomenal.
Yeah.
But there were some questions about the diet, you know, where there was a lot of not real food substituting
yep.
for the meat and dairy that people were giving
yeah.
up.
What can you elaborate on that? What not real food?
There was a lot of use of soy products.
Yeah, yeah.
Soy cheese, soy yogurt,
yeah.
Soy
yep.
burgers.
Yeah, yeah. I thought that's what you meant by that. And I don't know, because I'm just becoming familiar with the program, but I am a believer in whole foods for sure. I love tempeh. I don't eat it very often, but I do like it. I don't have any particular concerns from a health standpoint about soy products necessarily. However, I hear you that it's not real food. I mean, there's the vegetarians that live on, I mean, you can be a very unhealthy vegetarian, right? You can have a donut, glazed donut and a Coke for breakfast. That's vegetarian. Hardly what I would recommend. I mean, Boca burgers and all these things. I occasionally eat some of those things. I'm not a complete vegetarian, by the way, but I have a sort of a plant slant for sure. And you know, it's not real food. I agree with you. It's not real food. It can be used, but it shouldn't be like this. I am not going to go there. Not while I'm being taped. So I got to know, just like you and your patients, don't say this because you're being taped. I know it was going to, I thought it. So, you know, there are a lot of restaurants who will sell you stuff that's really fake food, and I would encourage you as much as possible to eat food as grown. And I will see if he's made some progress since you were in the program. I will mention that to him and say, I'll ask him that specifically at the conference. I don't want to run over. I think we're probably going a little bit long. So I'm going to close shop. Happy to spend a couple more minutes with you. And then I really do need to get on the road. Okay? Thank you, guys.
Yeah, thank you.